Well, hello. How's your week been?
It's been okay. What about you?
It's been okay. I went on a Horrible Histories Terrible Thames boat tour yesterday.
Oh, where did you go? Where did you go?
On the River Thames.
Oh.
Yeah.
What was it like?
It was good. We went past your place of work and they told us that the reason that Parliament is on the river is so that an angry mob couldn't surround it on all sides.
Is that true?
That's what they said on this boat tour.
Wow, sounds good.
And you've been at the Stump this week?
At the Stump?
Yes.
I think it's on the Stump.
Oh, actually. Sorry, on the Stump.
At the Stump is like, you know, visiting the tree that's, you know.
Right.
I've been stumping, yes. I was stumping with Sadiq on Friday. Yeah. I was stumping in Wales.
Keep on stumping.
Stumping at the Port of Tilbury in Thurrock. Yeah, keep on stumping.
It's a lot of stumping.
I enjoy the stumping. In fact, I had a situation where a guy met me on a train station. Where was I? I was coming back from Wales, and I think he'd had one or two to drink. And he said to me, because we were waiting for the London train, and the train that pulled in wasn't London train. He goes, no, it's not the London train. He said, do you know, he said, you look like a lot like that Ed Miliband. And I said, oh, yeah, actually, lots of people say that to me.
But that must be a weird moment when somebody says, oh, you look a lot like that Ed Miliband, and then what you're supposed to say, it is I.
And actually, when I was doing the event with Sadiq, in fact, in the last few weeks, I've had two of these incidents. That a lady, we went to a coffee shop around the corner, I think it's around the corner from you, actually, just before the event, and she said, you live on the blah, on the X housing estate, don't you? And I was like, no, actually, I don't. And she said, well, you look incredibly familiar. And I had also this thing where I knocked on somebody's door in Sheffield, and they said to me, I've seen you in Surbiton before, haven't I?
I mean, they might have done.
Which was incredibly specific.
I've told you before, I think you could earn a good money out of a side hustle as an Ed Milibandogram.
Go on.
You know, like a Tarzanogram. You turn up at people's parties and sing happy birthday to them as an Ed Miliband lookalike.
Well, do you think so? That's a way to raise money for the Labour Party. You think it might be a sort of, you know...
Yep, tell what's-his-face Keir Starmer about it.
But you know what's interesting is about this is that I was with Daniel... at something, and we were discussing this being recognised, and he made the point to me, and you know, but sometimes I think for my kids it's not great, but people's stories are very interesting. I mean, I know we've sort of said this. I said this to you before. Like, I met a guy who was a computer programmer who got to work at BAE Systems. I met a Canadian doctor. We were actually at the theatre. I met a Canadian doctor who'd come over, wanted to work in Britain. I thought it was a really interesting story, but he basically had to spend 2 years qualifying, including showing he could speak English. And currently, because he was also a rowing coach, he said he was coaching the civil service rowing team.
Wow!
Because while waiting to qualify as a doctor, but you know, I sort of did make me wonder why is it taking 2 years. Why did you have to wait 2 years to qualify as a doctor?
Didn't you ask him?
First of all, I had to show you could speak English.
Uh-huh.
Which is strange, because he was practising in Canada and Australia. But then, he had spent 2 years qualifying.
You see, you do have interesting conversations wherever you go.
Yeah.
Now, I have something that may be of help to you on the Stump, but you're going to have to bear with me on this.
Go on.
This is from today's Observer, and the headline is, Smell is really important for social communication. How technology is ruining our senses, by Ned Carter-Miles. So,
right.
Says, with the average person's screen time now nearly 7 hours a day, and much of that spent indoors, our over-reliance on sight...
Sorry, is that true?
I guess they have fact-checkers at the Observer.
I suppose it means... What you mean by screen time, doesn't it? Anyway,
yeah. Do you ever check your screen time on your phone? Do you get a thing that pops up once a week?
I used to.
You turned it off. Yeah. Anyway,
I've upended you.
Oh, I've got my daily average, if you're interested.
Go on.
6 hours and 28 minutes.
But does that include, like, being on a computer?
I think so.
I don't really believe that can be right.
Sounds a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Says, much of that time is spent indoors. Our over-reliance on sight and sound has only intensified So is neglecting some senses in favor of others affecting our emotional lives? The answer is almost certainly yes. For example, it has been shown that we tend to sniff our palms unconsciously after shaking hands with someone.
I mean, can that be right?
It says it gives you hints about all sorts of things, from their health to their age, even their personality. A fair amount of that is lost if we're interacting digitally only. I've got no muscle memory of ever sniffing my palms after shaking hands with somebody.
I find that quite hard to believe.
Seems unlikely, doesn't it?
Also, it would be quite a rude thing to do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I wonder if we're just all doing it subconsciously. Then it asks an interesting question. Would technology that could deliver smells and tastes be a gift to unscrupulous advertisers? It has a great potential to influence our decisions because we are very emotional decision makers, says Micah Scheller, an assistant professor at Durham University. Studies have shown that exposure to certain tastes and odours can influence our judgment of other people's appearance and personality. Tasting bitter foods, for example, can make us hostile. And there was a patent application in 2005 that suggested that the smell of pink grapefruit will make a man perceive a woman to be younger than her actual age.
Crumbs. I wonder what effects my black bean soup has on people.
Do you find it affects your odour?
Yeah. Or my kind of slightly problematic vegetarian lasagna.
So this is where the stump comes in. A study from 1940 showed that people were significantly more or less likely to identify with political slogans such as "Down with War and Fascism" or "Workers of the World Unite" and "America for Americans," depending on whether they were subjected to a putrid smell or given a free lunch.
Seems quite extraordinary. Are you saying I should start sort of on the stump wafting smells of freshly baked biscuits?
Yeah, not your freshly baked vegetarian lasagna.
Or the black bean soup.
Get a big fan and like a Kemper gas stove and have a pot of your black bean soup on the go at your political rallies in Doncaster and see where it gets you.
Why do I feel you're not being wholly serious?
But there is a serious point here. It says if the news allowed us and our leaders to taste air pollution in Delhi, feel wildfires in California, or smell the smoke and sewage in Gaza, would the appeal to our more emotional senses move us to act or to bury our heads deeper in the sand?
There you go. It's interesting, isn't it? Now, you flagged up to me, rightly, this Swiss climate judgment from the European Court of Human Rights. A group of older Swiss women have won the first ever climate case victory in the European Court of Human Rights. And basically, these women, the group of older Swiss women, they took this case, and their age and gender made them particularly vulnerable to the effects of heat waves linked to climate change. The court said Switzerland's efforts to meet its emission reduction targets had been inadequate. And it's the first time the court has ruled on global warming. Now, it's quite interesting, actually. You prompted me to read in more detail the summary judgment. And it's rather interesting, this, because it's sort of interesting to pick your way through this. And I'm obviously not a legal expert, but I will try and explain it.
Do you know anyone who is?
It's quite informative. So basically, the court says, first of all, that climate change does pose a potential threat to human rights. Dangerous climate change can pose a threat to human rights, in particular, limit global temperatures above 1.5 degrees, which have been sort of set out as a kind of dangerous, beyond that being a particularly dangerous level. It actually rejected the standing of the four women in the case. I know this is sort of slightly counterintuitive given what I just read out, because it said that they hadn't proved that the harm would be to them. But it then allowed the body that took the case on their behalf to have standing in the case. And what's really interesting about this, the reason I mention this, is because it rather implies that there's a sort of intergenerational aspect. You remember the Future Generations Act?
Yes.
That we went through. It sort of rather implies that the part of their motivation here is to say that there is a sort of future generations aspect. And then basically, the reason I'm going through this in some detail is because it's important to understand what the court isn't saying here. You see, they're saying that governments have what they call a margin of appreciation, so a large amount of discretion in its decision-making. Mm. But they take the combination of the Paris Agreement 1.5 degrees and the fact that Switzerland has these targets that it apparently hasn't met and various other things that it hasn't done to make its judgment. So I think sort of what's interesting about this is, you know, is this the court substituting its decision-making for politics? I think the court is arguing no, because it's saying, look, we are responding to what in part to what politicians have said, which is 1.5 degrees, targets that they've set out. And also, I thought the other aspect, as I say, that was interesting was this sort of potential future generations angle to this, basically.
Yes, because these women who are mainly in their 70s, they brought it initially on grounds that because of the effects of the climate crisis already, that the heat waves meant that they couldn't leave their homes.
Basically, listen, let me just read you this bit. It says, the court found that the four individuals of applicants did not fulfil, having carefully considered the nature and scope of the individual applicants' complaints and the material submitted by them, the degree of likelihood and a probability of the adverse effects of climate change in time, the specific impact on each applicant's life, health or well-being, the magnitude and duration of the harmful effects, the scope of the risk, and the nature of the applicant's vulnerability, the court found that the four individual applicants did not fulfil the victim status criteria under Article 34 of the Convention, therefore declared their complaints inadmissible. As regards the standing of the associations, and this is the association that brought the case on behalf of them, the court held the special feature of climate change as a common concern of humankind and the need to promote intergenerational burden sharing rendered it appropriate to make allowance for recourse to legal action by associations in the context of climate change. Do you see what I mean? That is interesting.
Yeah.
As I understand it. So, well, I hope I've interpreted it correctly. Maybe Charlie Faulkner, who, by the way, Charlie Faulkner has a legal podcast. Have I mentioned this to you?
What's it called?
It's called Law and Disorder.
Ah, don't you remember we suggested to him years ago?
It took him a long time to follow our recommendation.
That's often how it goes with legal people, though.
Yeah. Now, talking of a long time and a quarter of a century, indeed, we talked last week about Final Curb.
Yes.
Did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah.
Your enthusiasm?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it did a really good job of being dense with typical Larry David observations on life, but also bringing back faces from across the series and very, very cleverly being belligerent about the Seinfeld finale in that it echoed it.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And did you feel it? Sentimental, because they tried to avoid it being, I've read a lot about it now, they wanted to avoid it being a big sentimental finale.
Yes, and I don't like sentiment in comedy. I you know, as you know, I'm an easy crier. I'll cry at adverts or anything.
Yeah.
But I don't like it in my comedy, and I didn't think it was sentimental at all. The very, very last moment, the very last shot, I maybe felt a slight stirring, but it was also funny as it all descended into chaos.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought he avoided sentiment very well, because that was the maxim on Seinfeld, no lessons, no hugging. And the last episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm was called No Lessons Learned. And what that turned out to refer to was no lessons learned about how to do a finale.
Oh, I see.
Did you like it?
I did. I thought it was great, and I watched it with my kids. I thought it was... I felt sentimental about it.
And you sent me the video that HBO put out of some behind-the-scenes footage where, after they call cut for the final time, various cast members start standing up and making sentimental speeches. And I've never seen Larry David look more uncomfortable.
Yeah, no.
He cannot handle it at all, can he?
No, it's interesting. Now...
Yes.
After umpteen quizzes, It's time to get my own back.
Oh, no. The bite a bit.
I have a 5-question quiz.
Okay.
For you on famous Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes.
Okay.
This is your specialist subject.
I never said it was my specialist subject.
There is large amounts of pressure. Right.
Okay.
Here we go. Question one. In series 4, Larry accuses David Schwimmer's father of having a problematic ratio of what to raisins?
Oh, is it? Is it nuts to raisins? Almonds? Is it almonds?
No, I'm going to give you half a point. The answer is cashew nuts.
Aha.
You are very close.
Yes.
Okay, next question. In season 6, Larry chauffeurs John McEnroe. Where does he divert to, causing consternation to McEnroe? And for a bonus point, what name did Larry have as John McEnroe's chauffeur?
Oh, I remember the episode. I can't remember where they went. I know they were supposed to be on the way to a Paul McCartney concert, but I can't remember.
They went to the cemetery and Larry was called Charlie.
Okay.
You got half out of two.
I just want to make the point.
Actually, half out of three, really.
I just want to make the point that I always give you multiple choice.
That is true. In series, I want to get my own back. It's a spike, as Larry would say. In series 7, Larry buys a baseball signed by whom for Susie as a birthday present, only to throw it to famous baseball player, Boston Red Sox baseball player Bill Buckner, and him to fail to catch it and to land on the street.
Oh, I would have got Bill Buckner, because didn't he famously...
Yes, let the ball through his legs, yes.
Yeah, and the whole episode revolves around that. I don't know, I'm just going to say Babe Ruth, because I can't remember.
No, Mookie Wilson, I mean, it was a very hard question. New York Mets player Mookie Wilson. In Series 7 also, Larry comes to blows with US star Rosie O'Donnell over what?
No, I can't remember.
Over who's paying the bill in a restaurant.
I mean, that sounds like it could be many episodes of Cobra Enthusiasm.
Yeah. And then the final question. In series 10, John Hamm joins Larry at lunch, accusing Richard Lewis of taking more than his share of what?
You're going to have to tell me.
The answer is hummus.
You are right.
They're it was one of these kind of social moments of, you know, you're sharing a dip as a starter. And Richard Lewis takes sort of rather large amounts of the hummus.
Yes, yeah.
And an argument ensues.
It's quintessential. Well, I'm humiliated.
Let me say, you showed determination, you showed good sportishness, and you showed half a point.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
We talk about the penguins.
Oh, I forgot about the penguins.
So the penguins are amazing, aren't they? So basically, Bertie Gregory, who apparently makes programs for the National Geographic, is apparently quite well known, has this absolutely extraordinary footage, and maybe we can put a link in the show notes, of 6 months old emperor penguin chicks jumping 50 feet from sheer ice cliffs into the water. I mean, isn't it? I mean, I know it sounds, well, I don't know what it sounds like, but it is absolutely stunning, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. It's, you know, we've all seen penguins go off the ice into the water, but 50 feet, and they don't even look like they're belly flopping.
But what I think is quite remarkable is they don't seem to be being led by an adult penguin.
No.
It's obviously just must be some kind of generational instinct, is that
yes.
right?
I don't know. It's a phenomenal thing to watch.
They all sort of toddle off towards this sheer ice cliff, and it is kind of like kids jumping into water, because they're all quite reluctant to begin with.
Mm.
And then once they get going, once one of them does it, they all sort of get going.
When you were watching it, did you relate at all to how you get yourself into that pond you go swimming in?
Definitely. I don't dive, really. And it's
Is the etiquette? You just have to go slowly down the ladder.
Well, no, some people dive in. Uh-huh. And it's like impressive, but not me.
Do you think that's a bit showy?
No, I just never learned to dive. If I knew how to dive, I would do it. Did you ever learn how to dive?
No. I can't imagine either of us being graceful divers.
No, thanks a lot. I mean, I'm just rewatching this thing. I mean, it's quite sort of inspiring, really. I mean, also, it's Antarctica. I mean, it's just also so beautiful.
Mm.
You've never been to Antarctica?
No, it's a long way, and I think you're on a boat for a long time, aren't you?
Yeah. I met somebody who'd been to the Galapagos Islands recently. They said it was amazing. I've always wanted to go to the Galapagos Islands, actually.
You should.
Got some one or two other things to do at the moment.
Well, there's time, isn't there?
There's time.
It's time to go and see those big turtles.
Oh, talking of big turtles, should we talk about our emails?
Yes, we should. So last week I mentioned that we were trying to pour cold water on the idea that our son had of us getting a pet tortoise. And Susan Tornetta emailed in, and I feel she's given me ammunition, not to shoot tortoises with, but to let him down gently. She says, "Hi, Ed and Jeff. While tortoises are fascinating creatures, they are less than ideal pets for many households, especially in our cooler climate. Tortoises need specific living conditions that mimic their natural habitat, including regulated temperatures and lighting. Also, their diet is highly specialised. Lastly, as Jeff mentioned, the legal implications of owning a tortoise are complex, and special documentation is required to own a tortoise legally. Some species are protected under international treaties." I don't want to be breaching international treaties. That would be embarrassing to you in an election year.
It would be bad.
Having a podcast co-host who's breaching international treaties.
Yeah.
She says, but keep up the chatteroo.
But hang on a minute. Here's Owen Lewis, Speedy the tortoise subject. Dear Jeff, in answer to the question, yes, tortoises can be left in wills. I inherited my pet tortoise, Speedy, from my late Uncle Vic 4 years ago. We're not sure of Speedy's exact age, but Vic had him since sometime in the 70s.
Wow.
Vic was an eccentric fellow who lived alone and used to amuse us nephews and nieces by putting cucumber slices over his eyes and letting Speedy crawl on his face to eat them. He also went through a phase of walking Speedy on a lead to his local pub here in Swansea. These days, Speedy leads a less exciting life with our family. He woke up from his hibernation a few weeks ago. He'd been asleep since November. We prepared him a warm bath and had a heat lamp at the ready. Our Labrador Crumpet generally gives Speedy a wide berth, but occasionally they'll curl up together. Our sons, Billy and Blake, aged 11 and 14, make sure Speedy is well-fed and watered, and he's very much part of the family now. But he still provokes the occasional excitement whenever someone comes to read the electric meter.
Wow.
There you go.
I'd not thought about the implication of having a pet that hibernates for, you know, it's out of commission for 3 months of the year.
Yeah. You've got sort of views on both sides, I would say, on tortoise ownership.
We're keen to be balanced in our presentation of the tortoise issues.
Definitely.
Now, do you want to take this next one? Because I saw it in the inbox and I have no idea what it's about. But I sent it to you and said, oh, yeah, I think I've got an inkling what this might be.
Now, from Flat-Footed Frankie.
Possibly not real name.
Subject 27 is a joke. Dear Ed, does your blood from the breast, not from a stone t-shirt still fit you? I can still squeeze into mine. Love from a former JCR, that's Junior Common Room comrade. Now, this refers to my Oxford College, Corpus Christi College, where we had a rent strike about a very large increase in rent. Now, I wonder whether his 27 is a reference to the rent increase that was being threatened, and the blood from the breast, not from the stone, is a reference to the college
motto,
sort of statue, symbol, no, a pelican, basically, which sits in the middle of the quadrangle in the college. So I wonder who Flat-Footed Frankie is.
Hang on. No, you just said some words by way of an explanation, yeah, but it didn't make any sense. You said blood from a breast, from the breast, not from a stone, is a reference to a statue of a pelican sitting in a quadrangle. That's,
I know.
There's no logic in that sentence.
I know. I think it was. I think it must have been part of a slogan or something.
Is this the thing that do you remember years ago they dug up old TV news where you've got your pudding bowl haircut?
Yes. Other people didn't really comment on my haircut, but...
Oh, other people did comment on your haircut. You were maybe insulated from that.
I was. Maybe I was. So anyway, well, there it is. I'm going to have to do some further research.
So was that your big campaign? What were you? You were elected the president?
JCR president, yeah.
Was it a fiercely fought election?
Actually, I won relatively easily.
What was your slogan?
My name was Ted, believe it or not.
I remember you saying you were Ted while you were at university.
I can't remember what my slogan was. Points on a postcard.
If anybody has any paraphernalia.
Vote for Ted.
Are there any badges, like buttons, like in American elections?
I don't remember badges, no. It was a relatively sort of low-key election with a small electorate.
But a landslide?
That's a comfortable victory, I think we describe it.
Should we finish with this one?
Yeah.
This comes from Julie Ann Richard, who says, wild animals in your life, Australia. Oh, do you remember we were talking about asking for any stories about animals that come into your garden or animals that aren't pets that you have daily or somewhat regular interactions with?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Julie writes, hi, Ed and Jeff. Your most recent podcast, where you talked about wild animals you might like in your life, foxes, badgers, giraffes, that was Ed's, made me think of the story I read earlier today, written by a friend of mine, about the profound impact wildlife can have when it moves in with you from an Australian perspective. This is written by a super talented friend of mine. I thought you might like it. And there's a link to an essay by Tabitha Carvin, who lived in a house where possums had moved into the garage. And then when she moved out, she found that she missed them and decided to find out more about our relationship with animals living close by and asked friends and colleagues and other experts about it. And she writes, I heard a stream of stories. There's a garden magpie called Maggie, old Seven Legs, the huntsman, who lives in the spare room. How would you feel about a huntsman spider living in your spare room?
Not so keen.
The skink who always stops to say hello at the washing line. My colleague Elsie told me about the time her family received a postcard from a friend addressed to all the human members of the household, but additionally, Dotty the dog, Shadow the cat, Bluey the blue-tongued lizard that lived in the backyard, and Penelope the possum that lived up in the roof. Upon reading it, Elsie's mum responded, outraged, "But what about Bocky?" Bocky was the frog that lived in the garden. All these creatures lived at the same address after all. And then she also interviews Dr. Pelle Cannon, who researches human and non-human coexistence at the Fenner School of Environmental and Society at ANU, and spent 2 years living and studying in a wolf sanctuary in the United States. She says, I think the answer is it's about feeling grounded. As humans, we can get very up in our own heads, she explains. But when you see an animal doing its animal thing, especially over repeat visits, it really brings you back down to earth and into our physical embodied existence. It forces us into the presence of the rhythms of life. It's humbling. It's a nice way to think about it.
I mean, I wonder whether that's true about the penguins thing.
Yeah.
I do find looking at pictures, as you know, of animals sort of helps take me out of myself.
Same here. Although, sad news, we didn't get to go and see the capybaras last week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Postponed to a later date.
Keep us updated. And talking of keeping people updated, just to remind people that next week we are due to be interviewing Mark Sears and Tom Baldwin, both of whom used to work for me, about their book, England, Seven Myths That Changed a Country and How to Set Them Straight.
I'm looking forward to that conversation. More stumping for you this week?
Oh, yes. Always stumping.
All right. Keep on stumping.
Keep on stumping.
Bye.
Bye-bye.